You're listening to Arrivé by the Cycling Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to this very special episode, a special Arrivé episode, I should say, from the Cycling Podcast Femina. We are discussing today the Vuelta a España Femenina and everything that happened across those seven stages. As always with an Arrivé episode, it's going to be full, well, it's going to be nothing but spoilers, basically. If you're expecting to not find out what happened, then go elsewhere and have a little watch and come back, or come and listen to our insight on exactly what went down in Spain. Joining me for all of that, in my cabana, I wish we were in a cabana, Rebecca Charlton, but we're not in a cabana, are we? We're not even together in a cabana.
We could have pretended, at least, that we were together in a cabana, but yes, one day we'll get there. But hello, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome, Rebecca. And I'll be interesting to hear about, well, partly because I've got a little insight that you said in the WhatsApp group that you were a bit underwhelmed by this race, which sounded very much like you had an opinion on it, Rebecca, which is concerning. You've come off of your fence because I thought it was quite, I'm going to go through exactly what happened, but just to get your initial sort of vibe check on this race, I quite enjoyed it because it was quite chaotic. There were winds were going everywhere. There were kind of incidents. There were penalties. There was changing of the guard. But yeah, but I hear that that's maybe you weren't so much on board.
Well, do you know what? I think that's exactly it. I think now I've looked back, I've got about 3,500 talking points across all the stages, as you do with any stage race, don't you? But I wonder if my feeling was that I wanted this like clear battle all the way through, and I, you know, this narrative to be like building to this person that crosses the finish line, and we're just kind of expecting a certain place a narrative's going to go. But actually there was just so many different things happening, so it wasn't a bad thing. But I think that's the feeling I was left with, is kind of, whoa, there's so much to digest there. Maybe that was it.
Yeah, there was it was funny, wasn't it? Because it felt like the names that were coming up at the beginning of the week weren't the names at the end of the week at all, for various reasons. Well, I should go through the race summary before we really get into it.
Yeah, let's do that.
Seven stages, as I said, which kind of ranged from pretty bumpy to really mountainous away to the riders in this year's Vuelta. I mean, there really wasn't a kind of a flat, straightforward stage, was there at all? In the first stage, Noemi Rugg flew up the final ramp to the finish with 175 metres to go to take an impressive win over Lotta Kopecky and Franziska Koch to take the first leader's jersey of the race. Unfortunately, Rugg's run in the GC came to a premature end in stage two. She had to abandon at 13 kilometres to go after crashing and fracturing her shoulder. In the reduced bunch sprint, Shari Bosite managed to power to the line first despite a bump with Kopecky in the final metres. Kopecky was relegated to 36th for her line deviation, and Koch took red. It was a late solo break with 2 kilometres to go that saw Cedrine Carabol take stage three. The Frenchwoman could not be caught by the rallying pack behind, taking the stage by 4 seconds over Kopecky. Kopecky would finally have her moment on stage four, though. In yet another technical finish, she launched for the line with her teammate Anna van der Breggen in her wheel for second. Kopecky also took the red jersey. It would be another SD Works 1-2 on stage five. In a chaotic, wet, uphill sprint, it looked as if Misha Bredevol would deliver teammate Kopecky to another victory, but it was the Dutchwoman herself who enjoyed the plaudits this time. Then we hit the mountains on stage six. It was Carabol who made the first move on the finishing summit of Les Prairies. Van der Breggen led the chase back and kept going at tempo, which proved too much for the likes of Pauline Ferrand-Prevot and Kasia Nieuwiedoma. Only Paola Blassi of UAE ADQ and Marion Brunel of Visma Lisa Bike could stay with her until they couldn't. Van der Breggen pulled away to reach the summit first, 8 seconds ahead of Blassi and 29 ahead of Brunel. Van der Breggen went into the GC lead with only one stage left to go. And then the Angleroo. Liana Lippert was the longest survivor from the breakaway. It was Petra Stiassny of Human Powered Health who forced the catch from behind. Only the very top GC contenders could stay with her. Van der Breggen, Blassi, Bunel and Juliette Berthet. White jersey Bunel took her moment, immediately gapping the rest. Blassi went off in pursuit, managing to reach and overtake Bunel, while red jersey Van der Breggen faltered. Stiassny recovered, though, also leaving Van der Breggen behind, still with 3.6 kilometres remaining. Stiassny then picked her way past Bunel and then Blassi, taking a historic win at the top of the Angleroo. Blassi came in next, crucially beating Van der Breggen by 36 seconds to secure the overall title for the Spaniard. Bunel completes the podium and takes the youth jersey. Well, I mean, that was a huge summary, and I was kind of like endlessly saying the word Capecchi at the beginning, and then endlessly saying the words Blassi and Van der Breggen at the end. But that kind of was how it was, wasn't it? I mean, we came into this race without Demi Vollering, who has had years and years at the top of the doing the Spanish block every year and dominating it. I mean, taking so many of the wins in Spain. And so we came to this Grand Tour not knowing exactly where the wins were going to go or what the shape of the race was going to be without her being here. And obviously we were looking at the beginning at the likes of Cashinier Vidoma and Pauline Ferrand-Prévot to maybe be the ones that would be vying for the title at the end. And we did see at the beginning, didn't we, a lot from them. We saw the likes of Pauline Ferrand-Prévot attacking a lot and being near the front and kind of looking to always find a few seconds here and there. And same with Cashinier Vidoma. But yeah, Becca, what do you make about this race without Vollering? I mean, it's been kind of both a mix of seeing the young guns come to the fore and then also having this fantastic Anna van der Breggen, who just seems to be keep on building towards what was her best a few years ago, doesn't she?
Yeah, you've led me perfectly into my first point, which was like my overarching feeling was we had this huge juxtaposition of feeling like you'd turned the TV on several years back and seen the riders you expected to ride in that way doing those things again. And yeah, like the older class. And then, of course, the contrast with that is you had the new kids coming through and doing incredible things and just shock turning heads. And you see a lot of these riders who you'd expect to be battling for the white jersey. But I think we're seeing this across the sport as a whole in men's and women's cycling, that these young riders now, the confidence, the level of confidence they have on their shoulders in their early 20s is phenomenal. And I will go back to the point, Rose, what were we doing at 21 and 23? I'm not sure, but
probably the same as what we do now, which is being in a McDonald's drive-thru at 3 a.m, probably, unfortunately.
And that's evidently not what Paola Blassi is doing. She's not on Wandsworth roundabout at 4 a.m. scooping up Denny Gray's mozzarella bites, is she? That's not what led her to this success. But, you know, we've got these really young riders that are not only super strong on these massive climbs, but they're riding intelligently way beyond their years. And I think, yeah, as I say, that's something we've definitely seen in our sport more recently, is we do have these increasing expectations for younger riders. But yeah, going back to the other point, we saw Anna van der Breggen riding like, you know, days that we expected in the past. And I think, yeah, there were two really big talking points from that as well. And we had a Cedrine Cabal throwing in the, you know, the long launch attack that she became famous for in this peloton. And Capecchi back doing Capecchi things with SD Works. So yeah, I think there's so many things to really pick apart in there.
Well, let's talk a bit about the overall win, because it was amazing from Paola Blassi. Although we kind of knew not to, I mean, I'm going to use this as a Lizzie Banksism, which is to, we knew not to be blasé about Blassi, didn't we? We knew that.
Nice.
I mean, Lizzie actually suggested that she thought that Anna van der Breggen was being a bit blasé about Paola Blassi, in fact, at the end there. But we knew not to underestimate her, because she obviously won. It feels like we've been speaking about her on every podcast that we've done for weeks now. But, you know, she won the Amstel Gold race in a bit of a sort of breakthrough fashion, wasn't it? She was in a break with Ninka Vinka, and then, I hate to say it, left Ninka Vinka for dead. Becca, I know you're Ninka Vinka fan club president. You won't like that. But she was absolutely electric there. And then we saw her in Flèche Wallonne. being there right to the end, not getting the win, but being so, so close. And so we kind of have learned to expect the unexpected from her, expect that Paola Blasi also will ride with such confidence, which is quite rare for a rider who is relatively new to the peloton, and even rarer for a rider who comes from another sporting background. Often we get riders who come from rowing or running or duathlon, and they never quite get the racecraft or the racing confidence to make the difference. They're kind of more into either following wheels, or they have to be in a breakaway in order to win because they need to kind of have a bit more sort of space. But that's, obviously not what we've seen with Paola Blasi at all. I mean, she's just gone from strength to strength. I know that we were aware that she was going to be going very well here. But I mean, to have had so many months now of, being at the top of her game. I mean, I'm thinking back also to the town tour down under, where she was right up there in that when Noemi Rugg won and was beat three UAE riders. Paola Blasi was one of them. So it's been a really long season so far for her, and she's just continued to go from strength to strength.
Completely. And I think, she's an incredibly exciting rider, of course. And you've really just nailed it there in that explanation. It's not just that she's super strong, it's the way she reads the race, it's the way she rides. And actually listening to her appraise her own performance, and I'm not there's this danger of sounding patronising when you're saying, oh, these riders are so young, and but she's not inexperienced at all. She is really, really showing that she is just playing it so, so well in these races. And I think one of the things that she was talking about after not taking victory on the stage on stage six was that she was looking at the gearing choice of Anna van der Breggen, which we can talk about more. But she said that she felt the only thing she lacked in her post-race quote after stage six was her cadence. And I find that really interesting, because to have that level of confidence to say, okay, I'm already firstly able to appraise a stage I've just finished really eloquently. But yeah, I was lacking cadence. Okay, what can we look at next time? What are we going to learn from this? And I do think that's another remarkable thing, and one of the reasons evident that she's got so good so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, in that stage six, when Van der Breggen kind of put... Well, I mean, did you want to talk about Van der Breggen?
Let's talk about it. Let's do it.
Setup, because that was... I mean, obviously, it's crazy also to suggest that kind of her bike setup was so integral to her win, when it's Anna van der Breggen, when you know that she's got so much strength and nous and experience. But it kind of shows a little bit of a continuation in the narrative of, since Anna van der Breggen has come back, she has been always trying to find another way of doing things, or a different way of approaching a race. And we saw that almost immediately at the Vuelta last year, which was kind of a bit of a comeback when she won, I think it was stage four, a very different stage to the stage that she won this year. But she was made, last year she made an attack on a downhill. It was kind of reasonably flat-ish finish, and she kind of was in a solo break, late solo break, and she took it then, which is not a kind of, not where we would expect to see the move be made. And also we saw her in Strada Bianchi also doing things differently, attacking in different places, not where you expect it. So I think that her sort of gearing choice, if you want to talk about it a bit more, Becca, comes a little bit from her finding other ways and other ways of being innovative to get the upper hand.
Yeah, I'm talking about these young riders like Paola Blasi being exciting. What excites me with the likes of Anna van der Breggen is, like you say, she's finding new ways to beat her rivals. And that's a really interesting entity to look at. And not only has she been around so long, but that adaptation has come from the fact, of course, that, in previous years, she, with these famous battles with Annemiek van Vleuten, those two were battling so far ahead of the rest of the peloton, weren't they? Let's quite frankly say, on those big, big steep inclines, they would just go and play their game together. Or she would go solo, and she would do these immense solo efforts as the gradient really kicked up. But now she understands, coming back into this peloton, that she can't necessarily play the game like she used to, and things have changed and leveled up and adapted. And what she's now doing is using her wealth of experience as a rider over all those years, added with the fact that she's been in a director sportif position and learned even more. And now she's applying that to today's modern peloton. And it's brilliant to watch, isn't it? And like you say, you know, you can't say with her caliber that, oh, she's just got her gearing choice right. I mean, actually, the reason I really noticed it is because the gearing that she used was the same that I've got on my off-road gravel bike. And so I was really interested to see just how huge that cassette was at the back. And then she had the single chainring at the front, 46 she had at the front, I jotted down. And so, yeah, that's my off-road gearing. And it's really interesting that, yeah, she's really appraising her options and doing things differently again. And that's really good. But I think also the fact it would be very easy for her to come back thinking, I'm going to be able to ride away from everybody. Not that she's naive, but she is, you know, so classy that it would be easy for her to just carry this huge disappointment that she's not able to just smash every stage like she used to. And again, I think riders are just appraising, right, what do I do next? Where do I go from here? And how do I learn? And actually, that's a convenient segue onto Kasia Nuvadoma, isn't it? Because she put up an Instagram post saying she's not going to get low from this result. She's going to take it to learn. And I think that's something we've seen from Kasia in the last couple of seasons with her huge success, going back to that at the Tour de France Femmes, where she didn't have exactly what she wanted earlier on in the season. And so she went, okay, I'm going to go away. I'm going to work on this and I'm going to come back and peak for this huge target. And yeah, Pauline Ferrand-Prévot as well. It's interesting to see riders, because they can't be at their absolute peak the whole time. And riders are having to learn new ways of doing things and looking at things.
This is Arrive by the Cycling Podcast.
I think it was interesting about Anna van der Breggen's win and then her sort of subsequent loss. That doesn't sound too hard on Anna. But I thought what was interesting about it is when she won on stage six, it did feel like we've kind of got the Anna of the past back. I mean, just riding at a tempo that people can't keep with, and she just slowly went away. But then it wasn't quite that, because I thought it was really remarkable when she was coming across the line on stage six that she was having to look back and glance back and then put in another dig, you know, because she was looking back and Paola Blassi was still not that far behind her. And so she had to put in another dig. And that's kind of not what we used to always see. We used to always see Anna van der Breggen comfortably look around and had all the space and the time to, you know, sit up on her bike, put her arms aloft, didn't have that sort of panic, I better just do one more little acceleration, one more just to get to the line first. So it's kind of like, as much as the way she was riding seemed like a callback from the past, it actually wasn't. I did wonder if maybe, thinking back to all of her wins, I mean, she's won, Anna van der Breggen won the Giro d'Italia four times, and the Giro has always been extremely hard. It is, and back in when she was winning it, back kind of 2014, 2015, when she started winning the Giro, it was probably the only race really that consistently came up with high mountains. She would obviously just boss that. But now we're at a point where you not only have these high mountains and repeated high mountains. So kind of we have, you know, had stage six was hard, stage seven was hard, one after the other. Not only do we have more mountains now, but we also have a situation where you're having to race aggressively and race against another rider who is almost as good as you, or is as good as you, or even better than you, on these mountains day after day. And I don't think that actually Anna van der Breggen has loads of practice in doing that. I mean, when we used to have those battles between Anna van der Breggen and Annemiek van Vleuten, like you were referencing, Rebecca, even then, a lot of the time, the difference was made, and then it was just kind of the gap was set, and then Anna van der Breggen won. And if I think about the Giros that she won, you know, she won them by 1 minute, 40 seconds. She always won it by over a minute. That's not what we're seeing now at all, is it? I mean, it's so much closer. And I think it's a different kind of effort that is required in racing aggressively to the line up a mountain and then having to race aggressively up a mountain again the next day. It's slightly different from racing, making the difference, and then kind of controlling your effort and then getting to do that a second day. So I think it's also a little bit uncharted territory for Anna van der Breggen. So in some ways, I wasn't surprised that she, as strong as she looked on stage six, I wasn't surprised that she couldn't follow it up on stage seven. All of that being said, in the end, she didn't actually lose that much time from Paola Blasi. I mean, it was kind of 20, 30 seconds, wasn't it, on the line on the Angleroo, which is really nothing when you see how it was almost like a race through treacle, wasn't it? I mean, everyone was kind of, the gradients were so steep, it was kind of like a slow motion race almost. So, in the end, she kind of recovered. And she did say at the end that she was annoyed that she kind of let that gap go at all on stage seven, but it just felt too much at the time. But that she had actually recovered and come back a bit and kind of closed the gap again. So it was really interesting to see that. But it did feel like a changing of the guard, didn't it, Rebecca? Because of the fact that we also had Petra Stiassny, human-powered health rider, who is only 24 years old. She won on the Angleroo and she was phenomenal because the fact that she could come from right behind and pick off everyone as she went and keep going, it's really hard to do on gradients like that to make the difference.
Yeah, completely. And that's the thing, going back to what you were saying about Anna van der Breggen, is, you know, we used to just see the order of the day set out, didn't we? And then that's how everyone would cross the finish line. No one could come back. But it proves that, yes, we've got closer contenders, and you also don't always know where those challenges are going to come from. And I think Anna knows that now very well, that, you're constantly attentive to who's going to be changing that order on a steep climb. And yes, oh my God, the gradient. When you got that shot with the camera pulled to a wide shot and you saw the extent of it, it looked like a joke, didn't it? It looked like someone had like tilted the camera because it was so extreme. And yeah, I think that my final point on Anna on those gradients was that in those famous battles, back in the day, I always used to think she looked like she was at a day spa. You know, you looked at even Van Vleuten's face and she was like pain face, like all over the bike, like really pulling the power through. And you'd pan back to Anna or forward to Anna, wherever they were positioned to each other. And she'd just have this pleasant smile on her face that did not indicate that she was on like the toughest climb of a Grand Tour fighting for the victory. So it was interesting, yeah, that I do still think she just has that way of looking so comfortable on the bike as she's just absolutely decimating everybody behind. But back to the point of not knowing where the next move's going to come from, Petra Stiassny, trying to say that correctly, Petra Stiassny from Human Powered Health. I loved the images and the shots of her after the finish line because she was just like jaw to the floor, wasn't she? Just like, oh my God, this has happened. And she was so happy. And that is a beautiful moment, isn't it, in our sport, to just see what that meant to her. And what a ride, like what a pure climber she was that day to sort of finish that off. But I think what's interesting about Human Powered Health, Magnus Backsted has come into the fold as the head sports director there, and there's obviously been a lot of positive things happening behind the scenes. And I think it's a team that have always had interesting stories coming out, and they're obviously in a really good place. And I think I was speaking to Magnus a little while back when he was with Canyon Tram about the approach he'd taken to build confidence in riders and take this holistic approach to absolutely everything they needed to take victories in bike races, to believe in themselves as individual riders and to gel as teammates. And that's obviously something that he's carried forward now into this team that he's now working with. And I think that's evident because, you know, the confidence it takes to pull something like that off. I just thought, what a brilliant ride and what a moment for her and the team.
It was. And to give a bit of background, I guess, on Petra Stiassny, because she's not a name that we probably, I mean, we see her a lot in the racing and she can be right up in the business end, but she doesn't necessarily get, we don't necessarily talk about her on the podcast an awful lot, because if you're not getting the actual like wins or on the podium, then, you know, we sometimes pass some riders by. So just to give a bit of kind of context on Petra Stiassny, she's only, this was her only her second pro win. Her other pro win was the Grand Prix Boqueron, which I can't say I've actually heard of, which is an El Salvador race in 2025. And she won there a 9 kilometre uphill time trial. Her other kind of notable result being like back in 2022, and she came fifth on the stage, a very climbing stage actually, in the Tour de Romandie, which was won by Ashley Moorman with Annemiek van Vleuten coming in second there. Longo Borghini coming third. So for her to come fifth back then, several years ago, when she was kind of just starting, actually starting out as a pro rider, she only came to road cycling in 2020. Just phenomenal how far she's come since then. And what I loved about her story was that she'd said in the post-race interview that she had always been targeting this race. So as soon as she saw this stage, I should say, not even this race, just this stage, this Angleroo stage, stage seven, as soon as she saw that was released, she worked entirely to make it there and to do well on that climb. It was a bit like, it reminded me a bit of, and listeners, I do urge you to go and, well, sign up to be a friend of the podcast to go and listen to my interview with Magdalene Valliere, who's, of course, the current world champion. But it was a similar sort of reflection that Magdalene Valliere had about the world championships, where as soon as she saw that profile come out, she just spent her whole year working towards being at her peak, being at her best for that one day. And it reminded me of that, because it was said a lot on the commentary that, you know, she called the climb beautiful, but she went out there and achieved it. And I think she had in the back of her mind that on so many occasions she'd had crashes or got caught behind or was the wrong side of a break and hadn't been able to fully have the opportunity to show what she actually can do in a race. I think it was in Tour de France Femme. It might have been actually the inaugural Tour de France Femme. I think she crashed in the first stage. So, you know, she had this great opportunity to show what she could do and then it was kind of taken away from her. So I think it was also a real vindication of her method and her ambition. And I think it's going to be a huge confidence boost to her. A little bit like I was actually wondering, Becca, what you thought about this, about whether Paola Blassi, if she hadn't have won Amstel and subsequently done so well in the Ardennes, if you thought that she would have been up there today, oh, not today, up there this race, or whether you thought that Paola Blassi would have not have, I imagine she wouldn't necessarily have had the support from the team for one thing to come here and do it. So it's kind of that confidence breeding results, isn't it?
Yeah, that's so true, because it's not just the individual build of confidence in that rider, is it? Your team's got to have the confidence to throw everything at that race to make you the designated leader, as you say, to have the opportunity in the first place to go for it, which is what so many riders lack, is we don't get to see their full ability if they're riding in support of others, or we're just saying, oh, perhaps they're good for a young rider, but they wouldn't have the, you know, responsibility to take on the whole race. So I think, yeah, all of the above makes a huge, huge difference. And it's really important that you share these stories, isn't it, as to how riders have developed themselves to target a particular race, because it's no mistake, it's no fluke when you win at this level. And it's really worth saying that, because sometimes you're like, oh, there's this surprise victory, oh, well done then, but actually it's taken years of graft and confidence building and getting to the point where they can be trusted to go for that. So yeah, we're seeing the result of so many months of hard work behind the scenes for a rider to even get the opportunity to go for it. So yeah, it's no mistake at this level, is it, when you see a day like we did on the finale.
We should also have a word for Marion Bunel, because she was also phenomenal, obviously coming into the race as part of this Melissa bike with the likes of Pauline Ferrand-Prevot beside her. I mean, she wouldn't necessarily be thinking that she was going to have to go for the win or go for as close to the win as she possibly could at the end of the week. And she rode with so much confidence as well. I mean, the fact that she kind of took her earpiece out and just rode, she said she wasn't riding on numbers, she was just riding on feeling, she, you know, on the Angleroo on stage seven. And what I loved to see also was the fact that she, of course, was coming into that final stage. She was third on GC. And what I liked to see that she was going to take it to Anna van der Breggen and she was going to take it to Paola Blasi. She wasn't going to just be content with getting her third place and be content with that. I think in years past, we might have seen that from riders. I think riders always give so much respect to people like Anna van der Breggen and back in the day, Annemiek van Vleuten as well, that they won't necessarily, they'll kind of trust that maybe Anna van der Breggen knows better about how to ride a mountain than they do. But we didn't see that. I mean, we saw Bunel, a really assured performance from her. I mean, she's just, is she 21 years old? I mean, she's really, really...
Yeah. 21, yeah.
Really, really special. She obviously took the white jersey there as well. Well, I think we've actually, I was going to come to you, Becca, but then I was suddenly thinking that there was actually a load of other stages that we haven't even begun to talk about that we should probably give a mention to. I mean, the whole Anna van der Breggen win and her contending for the GC also was a little bit part of a kind of seeing SD Works coming back somewhat back to the SD Works that we saw before. I mean, the SD Works of Pass would have won every stage, so it's not quite that, is it? But I mean, yeah, they had a decent run, didn't they?
Well, it wasn't bad. The race. Yeah, it wasn't a bad run, was it? And yeah, we do have to cast our minds back to the beginning of the week. But yeah, I do definitely think that we saw the signs of SD Work confidence of old. And I think peak to that was Kopecky in the red jersey, leading the race, calculating, looking around, chill as ever, to see if Misha Braid of old could take the stage. And they said afterwards, didn't they, that of course it was the plan. It did very much look like a plan. But to be able to pull that off accurately and get it right and not scupper the win for both of you, because they said if the, you know, if the scenario had been that Kopecky had to come round, she would have done, but she was timing it to see if she could allow Bredevold to take it, and they pulled it off. And just watching Kopecky dance on the pedals, like, it was just confidence of old, wasn't it? And I must admit, I did like seeing that. I do love a Kopecky confident dance into the finish line.
To be honest,
line.
It really confused me watching it, because this was like stage five, and I was watching it, I was out and about watching it on my phone, and I was like, oh, the race is, oh, it's finished. It's just suddenly, like, the finish line suddenly appeared and everyone seemed so chill about it that I just couldn't imagine that was actually going to be the finish line. But yeah, what would you think, though? But I think I would be a bit, I don't know if I would want to win the stage if I was Misha Bredevold like that, like, in a way.
Like it was like feeling like it was gifted.
Feeling like it was a bit gifted, which is like, oh, well, that's a nice gesture because you're kind of repaying me for my, you know, hard work in previous days. But I think I would want to only really win if I was actually the best on the day. Would you take that, well, Becca?
What I think was interesting about it is obviously Bredevold did start the full-on lead out for Kopecky. And as you say, because they looked so chilled about it, in particular Kopecky, it was easy to think like, oh, everyone's just floating across that finish line. But of course, they were absolute full sprint pout and they still had the ability to do it. So I guess from that point of view, Bredevold did the lead out and then took it. And actually, that was pretty remarkable. And I think it's easy to underestimate it. So maybe the way they did it, she'd be like, yeah, cool. We pulled that off. But yeah, had it been a different scenario where it was much more like, oh, okay, like, yeah, I'm going to give this to you. But I don't think it necessarily was that, because of the pace she delivered it and the way she'd already done the lead out, I guess.
So basically, Becca, you're saying that you're just happily take any gifted win.
I'd just take any gifts. Send me some gifts. Yes, I think it's less of a gift when it's Bredevold because she's so damn good. But the fact, I think the overarching thing is the fact that they could pull that off shows where Estee Works were at this week.
It's funny also because it's not like Capecchi had been... I mean, Capecchi obviously had really strong legs and she obviously was in flying form, but she hadn't got actually that many opportunities to actually take the win. It, you know, it's not like Capecchi had had three wins and then gave one to Misha Bredevold type thing. It was... she'd only had... I mean, she only won... She only won once. I mean, come on, Capecchi. Get your ass in gear. No, she won. She won the stage before. Basically, she won. You know, she won stage four, and she had looked like that. She was extremely strong and was obviously riding that stage four with a lot of kind of. I don't want to say sort of aggression, but she didn't want that opportunity to slip because we had seen in previous days that she'd been caught behind and hadn't caught back in time. And then in that second stage with Shari Bossite winning, Capecchi had kind of veered off her light. She was moving into a space that she thought was there that wasn't there because Shari Bossite kind of come through. And then she sort of, I think they even made contact. She swerved away and then she got relegated because of a line delineation. And then there was the Kerbal stage where obviously, Cedrine Kerbal was a late solo breakaway and she won that. And then Capecchi won the sprint for second, basically. So Capecchi kind of rode, I think, on stage four with that feeling like she really couldn't let that opportunity go because she's had a bit of a hit and a miss season, really. Obviously, she's got some good... fantastic wins like Milan-San Remo, but she hasn't had that sort of consistency at the top that we're quite used to her seeing.
Yeah, she hasn't had the pure dominance yet, has she? Sort of coming back from the difficulties of last year. So it is interesting. I think you never know, do you, what's being said in the team meetings? But obviously they decided that was the right move for them on that day. And perhaps because Capecchi had proven, right, yeah, I've delivered that one perfectly. OK, so now we can do the next plan, which is Estee Works stuff, isn't it, really? Because yeah, not many teams are like, OK, who are we going to pick to win today? And to have the confidence to do that. But yeah, it was interesting. And yeah, going back to the... stage where, yeah, Capecchi did look to be in a really good position to fight, being led out by Anna Vadebregan. And then I believe that the clash with Shari Bossite meant that she pulled her foot out. And I've never really seen Capecchi go wide or kind of deviate like that or make a mistake, really, because she's just pure class, isn't she, in a sprint. She gets everything right. So, yeah, it wasn't like her to kind of come off the wheel so wide and get that a bit wrong, really.
This is Arrivé by The Cycling Podcast.
Let's talk about that stage two. We're just going everywhere, Becca, aren't we?
Let's do it. Let's just freestyle all over the place. We've thrown the timeline out the window. We're just too excited.
This is our free jazz Arrivé, everyone.
It is like that.
It doesn't make sense to talk about the Shari Bossite win, which was on stage two. Huge moment for her and for her team, actually, for AD Insurance Soudal to take that. Obviously Shari Bossite and Lotta Capecchi also know each other very well, don't they? I mean, you're a track... What do you call people who like track? Track heads. Track. There must be a good pun.
Track head.
If Lizzie Banks was here, she'd be shouting a fantastic...
She would have already got several up her sleeve, wouldn't she?
She would
have.
But you're a trackie, aren't you? You're a trackie pants.
Not that quick on the puns. I'm a trackie pants. Well done. We got there. Trackie pants. I love track racing. Grew up racing track racing. So I'm really delighted that we've managed to get it in this episode because it's not often I'm allowed to talk about it, is it? It's not always the most relevant. Shari Bossite. I haven't been drinking this morning. Shari Bossite and Lotta Capecchi have done very, very well as Madison partners on the track. At the top level of medaling in plenty of gold positions. So, they know each other very well, actually, which I think is easy to forget, isn't it, when you're looking at road racing and you forget that actually they intimately know each other on the track. But yeah, they had a clash. Kopecky pulled her foot out, and that's that scuppered her going for that victory that day. But to talk about the victory of Basait, I have, along with yourself and many people, seen that this was something that was going to come. I think, you know, she's just shown how strong she is, and she's just increasingly been up there in those gallops. And I think she couldn't believe it. I think in her post-race interview, she was just like, I can't really find the words to say anything because I'm kind of quite shocked that happened, which is interesting when you go back to everything that we've already said in this edition today about riders needing that absolute confidence to visualize, to plan for that day, to say on paper, right, that's the day I can target and pull it off, and to not have any wavering in that ability to believe you can do it. But she kind of, although it obviously was the plan that they would ride for her for that sprint, she was like, I can't believe it's happened. I have no words. Like when people say that they haven't like planned an Oscars speech, but then like deliver this perfection. Like she clearly hadn't done that, and she didn't know that she was going to take it. So yeah, I think it was another delightful moment of the week.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, Shari Bosite, because she's got such an interesting story. She's a 25-year-old rider, as you say, Becca. She's very well known on as a track rider, as a Madison rider alongside Lotta Kopecky. But it was a huge comeback for her. Her first ever Women's World Tour race win, because she's had a really hard few years. She served a 2-year suspension for testing positive for letrozole, a hormone letrozole. But French anti-doping even said that they had concluded that she had not intentionally taken the substance at all, but she still had to do 2 years suspension, which, you know, particularly for a very young rider, at that point, if you think she's only 25 now and she did the suspension from 2023 until 2025, that's a huge key part of her development that she's missed out on, when the anti-doping authorities have already concluded that she didn't intentionally take the hormone that she tested body for. So I think people will even remember that she had this press conference where she was just totally heartbroken, totally devastated, was saying how she didn't really have the strength to carry on fighting her case. You know, she's always stood by her innocence. So this is a huge moment for her. The fact that she can come back in this first year where she's actually starting the year as a pro. I mean, she only started back last June with the team. So to have already got such a huge win is also such an amazing moment for her. And actually looking back at her results this year, I mean, she spent the first few months, she was never outside of the top seven in all the races that she did. So she's clearly had it in her to get a win like this. And it's just because, as you say, Rebecca, she seemed so amazed by the win. I mean, that's, again, such a huge thing for her.
Yeah, and she has, as you say, she's been well up there in contention. She's almost taken it so many times. And I guess on the flip side of that, maybe she's got to the point where she was like, this is going to be another case of being the bridesmaid and I'll just accept that. And I think this will help her believe it now and to go from strength to strength. Because as I say, she's consistently been up there in so many sprints that I've called, but she's not quite got to that top position. So now I wouldn't be surprised if that, yeah, confidence breeds confidence and we see more and more from Shari Bosite. And that, you know, what she has been through and having to do that obviously so publicly is tough for any rider, but to do it as a very young rider is, yeah, tremendously difficult to navigate. So this will be a really, really big moment in her career.
Well, we also had stage three, Cedrine Carabol, also doing Cedrine Carabol type things, wasn't it? I mean, I actually thought that was her win was extremely reminiscent of the Tour de France Femme win, the first win, first French stage win at the newly revised Tour de France Femme. And it was very, very similar. I mean, it kind of even like the roundabout looked like exactly the roundabouts that I was standing on as she came through for that win at the Tour de France Femme, going with a couple of kilometres, brilliantly set up by Alice Towers, it should be said, her teammate. as well. I was surprised, though, that no one was jumping on that, because surely everyone knew that Cedrine Cabal would be easily able to get away and stay away at that kind of point in the race.
Yeah, because it's almost like a template, isn't it? Like, we know exactly what she's done in the Tour, and you're giving her the opportunity to do the exact same thing. I guess maybe because she has been riding so well in support of teammates, maybe people have kind of switched off slightly to the fact that she's going to be the priority. And then, sorry, Rose, I know we're freestyle jazzing because we haven't got there yet because we're going backwards. But of course, the team had to change the plan a bit. So maybe people were just off guard a little bit. But you'd think, wouldn't you, when Cedrine Cabal is like clicking down the gears behind, you're going to want to jump on that. But yeah, another brilliant win for her. And yeah, she's got her thing and she knows how to do it very, very well.
She does. I think also, and maybe, I mean, there was a huge amount, I mean, across all of the stages, I mean, because we're doing this Arriva and we have to be so kind of concise about, you wouldn't believe it, listeners, but we're actually trying to be concise here. But
is that what we're aiming for? Sorry.
But yeah, it's this crazy thing that, you know, a lot of these kind of other stories that are going on will kind of get lost because, you know, we're kind of focusing on sort of the real wins and the real major sort of narrative changes. But, you know, in that stage, there was a huge, Kasia Niewiadoma just seemed to be trying to go and go and go again and again and again. And it kind of probably also had a little bit of an impact on wearing everyone down. So when Cedrine Cabal went, and she went from about 5-6 riders back, it's not like she was right near the front, and it was all strung out by that point. It was all kind of in one line because Alice Towers had put in such a huge effort at the front. But yeah, massive for her. And then I think it kind of, we saw her, you know, heading onto the Angleroo first, didn't we? Also at the end of the week. So she's obviously feeling really good. And, you know, we know that at the Tour de France, FAM, it means so much. That's a race that means so much for her. And she will be really keen to kind of go back and do something there. She won the white jersey there in the past. She obviously got a stage win at the Tour de France, FAM. And I think she was so disappointed last year with about how things played out, because there's a lot of pressure on her to be the next great French GC hope. But she'll probably also benefit a little bit from the French perspective, from the fact that we have riders like Juliette Berthet and Marion Bunel, who are also fantastic French riders, that probably it takes a little bit of the pressure off Cedrine Cabal to become that GC rider, when actually maybe she is better suited. You know, we've seen the way she gets her wins is kind of breakaway wins.
Yeah, she's a really exciting rider. And it's interesting, actually, because I am darting around a bit here, but I was thinking this about Paola Blassi, is when you suddenly see a rider come to the fore and they're quite young and there's a lot of expectation and they have a brilliant season, it's almost like psychologically, where do you go from there? Because then the pressure gets on your shoulders, of course, that wasn't there before. And there's these huge expectations weighing on you. And I think, yeah, it will be interesting to see where Cabal goes from here. And as I say, we've also seen her in sort of like switching of roles in and out of whether or not she's riding for herself or teammates. And I think it'll be exciting to see what she can do at the Tour this year. Because as you say, the confidence she went onto the Angleroo with was, you know, an indicator of what is going on in her head. So I think when a rider suddenly explodes onto the scene with such big wins at the likes of the Tour, of course the game changes and that expectation changes. And it's how, I guess, not only how a rider deals with that, but crucially the support around them as well.
Well, let's head back to stage one, which makes total sense. We're winding all the way.
The cogs turning.
We're winding all the way back to the first stage. And I know, Becca, that you wanted, one of your kind of moments that you wanted to flag actually happened in stage one. I didn't even mention around Marianne Vos. I didn't even mention Marianne Vos in my little summary, which was not good from me. But yeah, what did you see as remarkable there in that stage one?
So the big one of the biggest talking points for me across the whole stage race was, well, Marianne Vos doing Marianne Vos things, because she came down. When we had a time check, and I think like the the moto, whatever, cameras following her, realised, you know, what a big time gap she had. And we were in the closing kilometres coming in to what would have been the sprint target for her. And yes, she was well off, like at least three groups back, wasn't she? Trying to chase back up, of course, to the lead of the race. And when we were looking at the time gap, and it was still like 25 seconds or something, wasn't it? Coming right into the finale. And she eventually had two teammates come back for her. And they drove and drove and drove and got back into contention for the final. Now, there's not many riders that could pull that off. I mean, it looked when they were still around 30 seconds like this is a good try, but this isn't going to happen. But it's Voss, and she got seventh, didn't she, on that stage in the end? So she got back into contention and sprinted for seventh. And then, after the stage, found out that she'd in fact done that with a broken collarbone. I mean, come on. She's just awesome, isn't she?
No, it's, you know, a phenomenal effort from her. And it was interesting, actually, also, because they had Lieke Nooyen, didn't they, doing a bit of the pullback. And then they had Marion Bunel, in fact, was pulling Marianne Vos back. So it was clear that they really, you know, Marianne Vos really must have felt that stage one would have been for her. And it is just, it is also so devastating that we didn't get to see her go for it when she, I mean, the fact that the determination just to keep going. I think there's other riders that would be like, okay, maybe not, maybe it'll be my day another day, and not have put in that huge effort for seventh place in the end. Of course, she didn't then start the next stage because she did actually find that she had this fractured collarbone. So she's going to be off for a while getting that fixed. But we should talk about the winner on that stage, also Noemi Rugg. She's another, EF actually had a great week, didn't they? To think that they had kind of the two stage wins. They're such opportunist kind of team, and that kind of has followed this week as well. But yeah, Noemi Rugg has been on fire all year, and the margin by which she won that first stage was phenomenal for something that was uphill, and she only opened it up like 175 metres, 200 metres to go, and she had really quite a comfortable margin in the end. Yeah.
And that's what we've seen from her, isn't it? Just there's races that we've discussed earlier this season where we've talked about what could other people do, and actually concluded nothing, because when she launches, she's just so damn strong. And yeah, of course, a big, big shame that we then lost her from the race entirely, because then she came down in a crash the next day. But yeah, let's just focus on that brilliant moment for her and opening the Vuelta as a whole, and just, yeah, the unleash of power that she has the ability to do is really, really impressive. And we've talked a lot about confidence of riders in this episode, and I do not see confidence ever faltering with her and the way she talks about navigating a race. She's just bulletproof, and yeah, goes off like a bullet. She's phenomenal. What a strong rider.
And she has had a fantastic year. She obviously won the overall at the women's, the Santos Tour Down Under. She then came second at Milan San Remo, which is remarkable, fifth at Amstel, and then to have a first place, obviously, as we say, that she, you know, she then crashed out the next day and has a fractured shoulder, so obviously wishing her the best recovery. And it's a shame not to have seen her on those other finishes, because it was so bumpy lumpy all week. It would have really suited her, wouldn't it? It would have continued to suit her for many, many days. So it was a shame not to see her there. Now, as we continue to go backwards, we're going to start talking about the Ardennes now, of course, Rebecca, because that's how this episode
what's happening
is.
Now?
We just continue going. No, we're not really. We're not going to keep going backwards. We've done this in a strange enough order anyway. But yeah, I mean, I think it was really exciting to not have a sort of Demi Vollering effect at this race. Also, I think it really enabled us to see the state of play for all the other riders, and kind of one of the big takeaways is almost that the likes of Kasia Niewiadoma and Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, I don't want to say have work to do, because obviously they have in there, and we know what Pauline Ferrand-Prévot is like, particularly in terms of knowing when to peak and when it's not so important and, you know, what she needs to do in order to get to that point. But it is interesting that these names that would have been on our lips at the beginning of the week are not now. And it kind of sets up the rest of the season to be really thrilling because we have all these different opponents all in sort of different states. I mean, we haven't seen, because of illness and injury, we haven't seen much from Longo Borghini this year. We haven't seen much from Marlon Reusser this year. So we've got like these kind of unknown quantities. We've got these kind of young guns who, you know, we just don't know what their potential is. We've got the likes of Anna van der Breggen, who's kind of just has all that experience and is coming back in. And we have, of course, Demi Vollering, who is off at altitude now and will be seeing at the Giro. Should actually say, that's a very good point for me to say, that we will be, I'm very pleased to say that the Cycling Podcast Feminine will be doing daily coverage from the Giro d'Italia, the Women's Giro d'Italia, which starts at the very end of May. So do join us for our daily coverage for that. We are really excited to be bringing you that because it's a race that has, for decades actually, deserved a lot of attention. There's always been kind of, you know, poorly scheduled or not had any kind of live coverage. And now it's in a really great place in the calendar where we can give it some full attention. And the riders also can give it some full attention. So we're really excited about that. But we will be back, won't we, to talk about all of the racing in the Spanish block because the racing continues out there. We better get a cabana sorted, Rebecca.
Please. Come on, Rose.
We need one, don't we, to talk about all of this Spanish racing. But Rebecca, thank you very much for your... I was going to ask you how many Spanish omelettes you were going to give this race, but it's almost too difficult, isn't it? With such a long, you know, to cover so many stages with one omelettometer.
Do you know what? I'd just give all my omelettes to Marianne Vos. There you go. She can have unlimited all-you-can-eat buffet omelettes.
She's going to really appreciate that when she's recovering, isn't it? Just like a stack of Spanish omelettes. That sounds really glorious. Anyway, Rebecca, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Rose.
And adios and thank you. Well, I should have said adios and gracias. Missed my opportunity completely. Adios and gracias, listeners.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.